Final case for argument this morning is 18-1141, Liquid Power Specialty Products v. Baker Hughes.
Good morning, and may it please the court.
Good morning. Could I just make a preliminary statement? There are a lot of confidential markings in this case, and it's very hard for the court to function in that regard. So we're going to assume you're following them. If you're not following them, tell us. And if we're off the hook for these conventional markings, that would make life much easier for us. So please keep that in mind as you're talking about this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. The PTAB committed legal error in invalidating claims 8 through 10 of the 118 patent, which covers an improved drag-reducing agent used with heavy crude oil through pipeline.
Can I get right to secondary considerations? Can you show me where in your briefing you argued nexus, apart from just arguing that there was a presumption because your patent embodied the product?
You mean in the briefs below?
Yeah.
There's in the 23 pages.
I've read the board's decision. I just reread it, and it seems like they read your briefing as only relying on the presumption and not establishing other direct evidence of nexus.
I believe considered the substance of those arguments, but we specifically specified three rationale for why there was nexus beyond presumed nexus, and I think there clearly was presumed nexus here, but I want to be direct to your question.
Let's just put that aside, assuming we agree with the board that there's no presumed nexus. Where did you argue that there was nexus without the presumption?
Right, and that was at A876, where we specified three different theories of nexus.
It would be great to ask you to go through some of this, but it's all marked confidential, so how do we do that? I don't even understand why 99% of it's marked confidential, but it is.
Yes.
Every single sentence.
We attempted to negotiate away as much confidential as we could. It's in general.
Hold the time, please. Stand up. Why is this confidential?
A great bit of the information that was put into the record was under a protective order in the district court. And according to the terms of the district court protective order, we were to preserve the confidential markings as they were.
That doesn't work anymore under our rules. Mr. Reines probably knows those better. Yeah. I mean, you have to come to this court to get more than 15 words.
Correct, and there were just 15 words in.
Sure, but the appendix is littered with this, and I'm going to say this because there is no way this is protected information. On page 876, in yellow, it has a number 2, and it has the heading, long felt but unsolved need. Can you explain to me how that heading is protected? It's not, right?
I cannot, Your Honor.
I mean, it's impossible. This is littered throughout, and it's even in the briefs. You put the name of the company in yellow at certain points.
Heck, there are whole sections where you discuss law that has absolutely nothing to do with the facts of this case. Let's go to footnote number 10. Evidence of copying may also show objective indicia of non-obviousness. And then you have three cases with parentheticals. Which of those cases is confidential?
Your Honor, I don't recall that or why that paragraph was marked confidential.
Are you willing to de-designate all of this?
That I am certainly willing to de-designate.
Are you willing
to
de-designate?
That meaning the citation of the cases?
No, I meant all of this.
Did you say yes or no for everything?
I was specifically referring to the footnote.
Oh, dear God.
However,
that's ridiculous.
If we can have our attention directed to specific.
Everything on page 875, 876, 877, 878. Basically, we would like to be able to deal with this important question of nexus and secondary considerations, and you've made it impossible to conduct an oral argument.
Okay. Your Honor, I think a point of clarification is required here in that we're looking here at the patent owner's paper, and it is the patent owner that designated that material as
confidential. So you're fine with all of this being public?
This particular.
Is there anything on these pages that you deem confidential?
The only thing, Your Honor, that I'm concerned about as far as confidentiality is the composition of the parties' profits.
Got it. What about you?
So stipulated.
So we can talk about anything in these pages related to nexus and secondary considerations, but for the formula or composition stuff.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Thank
you. Okay, so why don't you answer the question, hopefully, in a more full
sense. I don't remember the question.
I was going to do my best to remember it.
Do you remember the question?
I do. I think Judge Hughes was asking for the position of LSPI on how we showed nexus beyond relying on a presumed nexus in our briefing before the PTAB, and I identified page 876. And we specify three different reasons why the following information had nexus, and then we went through and then we explained the probative value. Nexus is a label. I mean, the theory of the obviousness is that someone would have gone back and used the 1991 drag reducing agent and selected that polymer for heavy crude oil, notwithstanding the fact that for decades people were trying to solve the problem of getting a good drag reducing agent for heavy crude oil. So anytime you're discussing about that, the nexus is very clear because people would have been highly motivated to go and use.
Can I just step back a minute?
Sure.
This is all very confusing for me. And we, as you know, we've got presumption issues all over the place. If not, what I think Judge Hughes was asking, and I just want to double down on that, which is, were you essentially making the argument, here's all the stuff for presumption of nexus, but even if you don't find that there's a presumption, which I guess just affects who's got the burden going forward, I'm not sure what the impact of
I think it's a burden shifting, yes.
Okay. But even if you don't find a presumption, technically that legal term, we had all this evidence on nexus for you. Because it seems to me that the board, I think Judge Hughes alluded to this, that the board seemed to say, well, you haven't met the presumption, and sort of suggest that, and you never argued if you lose the presumption, you've got anything more to say on nexus, so end of story.
I think, so this goes back to the issue I raised with Judge Hughes, is what the board actually did. I think the big problem that we have here, and the reason why there should be a reversal, is the board, whatever it did, was not as explicit about what its reasoning was on secondary considerations as it should have been, given the richness of the record, the quality of the record, the amount of time everyone invested in it. So whether the board was saying, we don't think you've tendered any evidence that there's a nexus beyond presumed nexus, or whether they were saying, we've looked at it and we think it's all so nothing that we're not even going to address it, I don't know which one they did. I think the opposing counsel takes the position that they said it's so little that we don't need to get explicit about it.
I don't even understand. When you argue failure of others, right, you've set up a problem that exists, drag. And then you go through and you give, on, say, page 879, a lot of examples of failure of others to be able to use polymers in a way that reduces the drag issues. I'm really baffled as to what additionally you would have to prove in order to have satisfied whatever the PTO's requirement is for nexus. I'm just genuinely confused. It seems to me that when you set out evidence of failure of others to solve a particular problem that the invention is argued to solve, that's secondary consideration evidence that just has to be considered at that point.
I think you're dead on, Your Honor. And I think another example of that equivalent is here we have a third major player in the market.
I understand commercial success and the concept of nexus there, but I'm struggling with skepticism of experts, unexpected results, failure of others. I just can't even wrap my head around the idea of what nexus looks like apart from the assertion that lots of people didn't believe this was going to work and lo and behold it did. I'm not sure what else is required in order to have that evidence considered.
Right.
I.e. to meet whatever the nexus requirement is.
I don't think there's any other legal requirement. The question is it probative to the issue?
So is
pending?
It your view that our cases which have, I guess we created this presumption of nexus sort of doctrine, that those cases really did what Judge Moore said, which is they were dealing with commercial success. And commercial success, I can kind of absorb the application of presumption, and if not, the burden shifts, et cetera. But with the other factors, do you know if the case law has ever dealt with the other factors under this theory of presumption?
The way I think of it with presumed nexus is that's if you're relying on a commercial product. So it could come up in other ways, such if someone's surprised by a commercial product, maybe it comes up. But I agree. And the one I think that destroys any concept that there's a lack of nexus most conclusively is the third competitor in this industry stipulated to the validity of the claims, 8 through 10, and withdrew their product from the market and entered into an injunction. That's acquiescence. So it may not overwhelm the analysis and dictate the outcome, but it certainly establishes nexus. And going to Judge Moore's insight, what would you do more than say the very claim was acquiesced to?
One of the arguments of the board, this is on the presumption question, which was that the product was only encompassed one, I don't know, I'm afraid to say anything, that the product uncovered one embodiment of the claim.
And, well, it's actually three, but...
And not all of the embodiments right. In the claim. Is that your understanding of the board's analysis on the presumption?
The board's analysis on the presumption suffers from the same problem as we've all been having with the other issue, which is in the body of their argument, what they state is that it's a method claim and therefore there's some difference. But no one at any point has made the argument that there's a difference between the method and using the compound. So
what are you seeking? I mean, is it sufficient for your purposes if we were to say, let's leave all of this presumption stuff aside. You, board, have to consider all of the evidence presented by the patent owner in this case in establishing whether or not the secondary consideration.
Right. And here,
But answer my question. Sufficient guidance? Because if we're going to send something back, we hate to send it back and then get it back again because it wasn't clear what we were intending.
No, of course. I mean, I think that, and I don't necessarily want to get into, you know, the full argument that would be entailed below, but you have it all in chapter verse. It's so compelling, the objective considerations, the objective indicia. And then when you couple that, and there's something a little bit weird about or unusual about this case, which is one of the claim requirements is that the drag reducing agent actually work to drag reduce in heavy alpha-tenic crude oil, which is, you know, kind of the difficult task. And the expert on the other side was asked, do you know of any compound that would actually work? And this is the person that's opining that someone would go back to a 1991 patent and get this polymer. Do you know of any that would work? And he said no. And then the other interesting thing on this record, which simplifies the problem solving, is that...
Did he answer your question? I'm still waiting for an answer to your question.
What guidance do we want? I think I'm saying that I think
right,
that it should be
a
reversal.
Maybe going to the sufficiency of, maybe we should just take this presumption. This isn't a necessary factor here, given the kind of evidence we're looking at. So it would be adequate to send it back to the board, not getting involved in whether they were right or wrong on the precise way they applied the presumption, and just say, go back and deal with the heft of these secondary considerations and nexus.
Right.
Of those.
I think that's
because you
sorry.
Put forth the board clearly got tangled up in the difference between a product and a method claim and whether the presumption applies or not. It seems to me that you don't need the presumption at all because, as you pointed out, you have put in a lot of evidence on a lot of different arguments in support of secondary considerations. So if we remanded to the board and said, you know, your presumption decision is incorrect, proceed directly to the direct evidence and consider nexus apart from any consideration is not going to harm you in any way because you pointed to all of the evidence in your favor.
That would be certainly an acceptable result.
I know you think you've got enough for the presumption.
I think there's enough for the presumption, which I can address.
Call,
yeah.
I guess I'm just going to go back to what I was asked. Did he answer your question sufficiently?
Thanks.
I just want to go back to what I don't. I don't even know why would we be sending it back and say, look right at nexus? I mean, I don't understand what the argument is for when you establish a bunch of people that didn't believe this would work. I don't know why they aren't just reweighing obviousness with the secondary consideration evidence included in the consideration of obviousness.
I think you're right. I think that's at a minimum what should happen. And if I got off beyond that, it was only to address whether I thought there was a record for reversal here. I do. If the court wants to hear that, I'm happy to present it. If not, I know it's been a long week. I think here, the opposing, so let me just say, make 2 points on the reversal point beyond the obvious, what I believe is the obvious need to remit.
You're not going to get reversal, but go ahead and make your 2 points.
Well, I don't want to waste people's time if I'm not going to get it.
Go ahead.
Obviously, I think the record's here.
So make it quick.
Otherwise, yes. So one is that opposing counsel stated in their brief that there's no record of anyone taking the position that the name in polymer would actually work. Okay, that's on page 15. They denied it.
The brief here.
Right, because they were trying to just say, look, we meet the reasonable expectation test. We're not saying it actually works, but the claims require it to actually work. Okay, that's A. And then B, when we asked the expert on the other side, do you know of any drag-reducing agent that would actually work in heavy alpha-ata crude that you saw in the prior art? His answer was no. So between him saying no and the opposing counsel not even defending the position, saying no one's ever said that it would actually work, the claims require it to actually work. Thank you very much.
We'll restore some rebuttal time. Why don't we hear from the other side, please?
All right. Morning, Your Honors.
So you have a lot to say that will respond to the discussion you just heard. So you might throw out the script you may have had and proceed to deal with the issues we're having.
Absolutely, Your Honor, if it pleases the Court. Let's go back to Judge Hughes' initial question, which is, where did you tell the Board that you had proved nexus? Okay, where did you do that? And you were given a citation to a single paragraph in the patent owner response, and that is all that the patent owner said about proving nexus.
Well, now, page 875 of the appendix has a number one, nexus to the claimed invention of the 118. And they then have a discussion of presumption, right? Right, there's a presumption.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah. And then they say, in addition, as discussed below, they talk about copying, and then they say all the evidence below has a nexus to the claimed invention because it relates directly to, and so they're not using the presumption language anymore. So the number one doesn't say presumption of nexus, it says nexus. The first paragraph talks about presumption. The next two paragraphs talk about nexus without using the word presumption. Am I understanding it correctly?
I believe you are, but I think what's going on here is that the patent owner relied on the presumption, claimed the presumption in its paper, and immediately jumped to a discussion of the objective evidence.
I guess I don't read their submission that way, since one paragraph is on presumption and the other two paragraphs are on nexus without using the word presumption. I think I understand that to be an argument that there's a nexus independent of whether they're entitled to the presumption. But even if you were right that the whole number one was about presumption, which I actually think clearly on its face it's not, when you get to number two, I guess I'm confused. When you have something like long-felt need, or you have praise in the industry, or failure of others, or unexpected results, or skepticism of experts, I guess I'm confused what it is that you think needs to be established before the court will look at the skepticism evidence. You know, for example, if a bunch of experts say, this is never going to work, this polymer will not reduce the drag, we're going to have the same drag problem that we've always had in these pipes, no polymers are going to help, you know, we're just screwed. I probably shouldn't have said that. So if it just said something like that, the expert, what do they have to prove by way of nexus to get the court to factor into the obviousness analysis the fact that an expert...
First of all, a number of the sort of background facts that you recited and that Mr. Reines did, that That's just accepting the truth of the fact statements that he's making. But let's leave that for a moment. According to this court's precedent, which is, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, In Wei Hung Cao, which is 639 F3rd 1057, this court says there's two requirements for proving a nexus. And the first is that the evidence is commensurate in scope with the scope of the claim. And the second is that the evidence is tied to a novel aspect of the claim. Now, that's not how patent owner argued this case to the board, and it really hasn't argued that to this court.
Here's one of your commensurate problems, as far as I'm concerned. If you have a chemical composition which includes a range,
yes,
hydrogen 0.6 to 27% hydrogen included. Now, they have an expert that says, oh, something with 15% hydrogen, boy, it's never going to work. It's never going to work for that purpose. Your argument would be it's not commensurate in scope with the claims, because even though it falls within the claims, is one embodiment within the claims, because it's a range claim, the expert didn't say nothing would work in the whole range. That's your argument, right?
On that particular point, it would be that it would be the patent owner's obligation to put on some evidence that said that other species within that range would have similar behavior. And that hasn't gone on here, really.
I don't understand your answer to Judge Moore's question. How much more would they have to show if you're within the range?
A single
embodiment. They have to also show other stuff in the range?
That there's some reasonable expectation that other members of the class defined by that range would behave in the same manner. Yes, that's what we understand the court's law to be.
I understand the reverse on coextensiveness. I mean, if the product is much broader and includes tons of other stuff that's not in the claims, then I can understand why you have to convince someone that the fact that you've sold 50 billion products has something to do with the claimed invention. But this is the opposite of that, right? This is where the argument, at least, is they're not coextensive because the product only covers one piece of the claims, right?
And that's correct, Your Honor.
Think that there's a distinction in the way we should analyze those two different models?
Yes, coextensiveness is identity. And in the Muni Auction case, we had a claim that covered method A and method B, and the product that the patent owner was relying on for commercial success only did method A. And this court held that that was not coextensive.
Okay. Now, can I go back to sort of this weird rubric we've been talking about presumption and nexus? Because I'm not sure what argument they might have had to make below in order to say, we want you, board, to consider this evidence of nexus. Even if you, I mean, I would think it might be implicit that if they put it on for presumption of nexus, even if their argument with respect to presumption is rejected, rightly or wrongly, there would still be an expectation they put on evidence of nexus and the board needs to consider that evidence. One, do you agree with that? And if you agree with that, do you think the board did that here?
I think the board treated nexus as a threshold issue for considering the objective evidence. And as I said, just on nexus, proving nexus, that either it's presumed or it's proved. And either way, showing nexus it's much like relevant.
Here, it seems to me the board got hung up on the presumption, and once it found there was no presumption, then it didn't proceed to address the nexus evidence or the evidence of the secondary consideration evidence at all without a presumption. I mean, if you look on Appendix 60, which is the end of their very, very brief discussion of the secondary consideration evidence, it says, we determine the patent owner isn't entitled to a presumption because they haven't directed us to additional evidence to establish nexus. There's no nexus to secondary consideration. But there's tons of additional evidence here about nexus, even if it doesn't satisfy the presumption.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think the distinction is between the actual evidence of objective indicia and the nexus of that evidence to the merits of the invention. And I think it's the second piece.
So you don't think there was any nexus drawn between the evidence that was put in on long-felt need, et cetera, that dealt with the product incorporating the elements of the claim?
It dealt with the product. It didn't deal with any inventive aspect of the claim. It's quite clear from the record, Your Honor, that the polymer is not novel.
Point me to as Judge Hughes pointed out, the board's discussion was relatively thin. It's appendix 57 to appendix 60. I think almost, maybe I'm wrong, seems to me every paragraph was really about presumption of nexus, but not talking about what we're talking about here is the guts of the argument with regard to nexus, not the legal theory of whether we ought to apply a presumption.
Correct, and I think what's missing here is that the patent owner didn't argue the legal requirements for showing.
So you said correct to my question.
Pardon me?
10 seconds ago, you said correct to the statement I made. I appreciate that. I'm not sure if you know what you were agreeing to. But my suggestion was that the only thing the board did was analyze the question, presumption applies, but it did not analyze just straight up, forget the presumption, the evidence of nexus with regard to all of these factors. Is that a fair characterization of the board?
No, I think what the board did, and this begins on page 57, of the appendix, that's page 57 of the final written decision, is it cataloged all the evidence that...
In the context of a discussion about presumption.
Well, it was before they even got to the point of presumption, is my recollection. They dealt with presumption first.
I mean, the first paragraph is just a background paragraph.
Correct, and it recites exactly what the board looked at. It catalogs the portions of the patent owner response dealing with each category of objective evidence.
And the next paragraph sets forth the legal standards. The next paragraph talks about presumption in general, and then in the paragraphs discussing the actual application of the law to the evidence set forth here, it's always talking about presumption. It's never talking about whether the evidence as presented establishes a nexus apart from the presumption.
Right? I mean, the next paragraph talks about their argument about presumption. The following paragraph says, we don't find it's entitled to a presumption.
Correct. And they were specifically addressing the patent owner's reliance at the oral argument only on a presumption. There was no discussion.
Well, let's say we disagree with you about that. I don't think that's a fair reading of their briefing papers, that they only relied on a presumption. Maybe there was some confusion here, but I think they've clearly put forth evidence of nexus apart from just presumption evidence.
They put in evidence pertaining to objective indicia. What they didn't do is connect that evidence to the merits
of
the invention.
That's what you think on the merits is should be the correct outcome.
Correct.
Where did the board ever say that?
The board's statement was admittedly brief, saying that the patent owner hasn't pointed us to evidence establishing a nexus. Nexus, it's the burden of the patent owner to prove that.
The problem is that statement follows them only considering the evidence they did supply under the presumption analysis and not considering it directly.
And wouldn't we expect the board to give us a more fulsome analysis of the evidence if indeed they were saying, well, even if the presumption doesn't apply, we've still got to look at the nexus evidence. Isn't the other side entitled, or doesn't the APA require that we have a more detailed analysis? If they're going to reject the evidence based on nexus or otherwise, don't they have to tell us what they're rejecting and why?
Ideally, there would be more explanation. I think there is some explanation, and that's in the footnote on page 60, and that goes to the point of commensurate in scope. And that's a key requirement for showing nexus. And the board made it clear that there was not evidence commensurate in scope with the scope of the claims in two particular respects.
I have a question. You cited Muni Auction to me a while ago, but Muni Auction was a presumption case. It wasn't a nexus case. It was a presumption case.
Correct.
Are you of the view that commercial success evidence or long-felt need or unexpected results can never be used to establish nexus as opposed to the presumption of nexus if it's just one of two embodiments disclosed? In Muni Auction, did they hold that evidence wasn't relevant for nexus or only that evidence wasn't sufficient to be entitled to the presumption?
I believe Muni Auction is a presumption case.
Right. Of course it is.
Correct.
Yes.
Okay.
But I'm confused. You answered my example to you about coextensiveness wasn't about presumption. It was about nexus. You answered me with a claim that Muni Auction covered my situation, but Muni Auction is a presumption case. I'm trying to understand from you, is it your view that anyone who sells a product which falls within the scope of the claims can never argue commercial success if those claims are to a range, because one product can never encapsulate all aspects of the range. So commercial success evidence would never be allowed to be introduced in an obviousness inquiry because no single chemical composition that was being sold could possibly fulfill the entire range.
No, Your Honor, that's certainly not our position, and that's not the law. My answer was based on your use of the term coextensiveness, which
Don't try to explain what you said before. Focus now, though, on my question.
Yes.
What is your position about my question, which is you have a range claim. You're selling a chemical composition. You want to argue that your sales of that composition amount to evidence of commercial success, which ought to be considered in the obviousness analysis. Is it your view that nexus would not allow that product to be considered, the commercial success of that product, in the obviousness analysis, because that product represents only one point within a range claim?
I do not believe that's our position. It's not our position, and I think that's a one piece of the puzzle in terms of nexus.
So you can consider prior art. I mean, you could. I'm sorry. Consider secondary consideration evidence, whether it be commercial success, long-felt needs, skepticism of experts, unexpected results, even though a claim may extend to multiple embodiments or to a range, you can consider that evidence for obviousness purposes, even though it only goes to potentially one embodiment within the range.
It can do so if it meets the criteria for establishing nexus, which is the evidence is commensurate in scope with the claim, and the evidence...
But is it your view that it's not commensurate in scope with the claim if they're selling one product with one particular chemical formula and the claim is to a range?
That's a very fact-dependent question. Here we don't have a composition claim at all. We have a method claim.
But you need to answer my question because I feel like that's your argument in a nutshell. What I just said is your argument in a nutshell. And you don't want to answer the question because that argument leads to an absurd result.
No, well,
and that's
certainly
what I'm demonstrating, and you don't want to answer it. So, I mean, but I need to figure it out. I need to figure out how to decide this case, and it implicates that broader proposition of law. And you would like me to mechanically walk through the law a certain way, but it leads to what I think would be absurd results if I do that.
Your Honor, I did not take issue with the fact that a commercial success case meeting other criteria on a single compound within a definition of a genus of compounds that certainly can be considered on the issue of obviousness.
Okay,
that's just not what we have here.
I have one further question, and maybe I'm sorry if it's redundant, but I just want to understand just in terms of the posture. Is it your view that if the board were to reject in a particular case that the presumption of nexus applies, it should still or consider the evidence of nexus, full stop, and that the reason the board didn't need to do that here was that the other side did not press that outside of the presumption context. Is that your view, or are you saying an alternative, which is the board considered the presumption, nexus evidence connects with the presumption, and it also considered it independently? So which of those is your position?
Well, I think in this case it's both. They recounted the evidence in the beginning, and then they said that was not sufficient to independently show nexus, but the fact is that the two requirements for showing nexus, as I said before, evidence is tied to a novel aspect of the claim and the evidence commensurate in scope. That was never presented to the board, and it's as if patent owner has thrown on the board the job of combing through the evidence and making the link.
I believe that the test is not commensurate, but reasonably commensurate in scope. And I think that you misquoted Huang, because I've got it on my screen now. Yeah. Reasonably commensurate in scope. So when you're talking about a range claim or a multi-embodiment claim, I don't know how you can sell a product that it could reasonably be commensurate in scope with the claim if it has to fulfill the whole range. No one product could do that.
I certainly misspoke, not including the word reasonably, but I don't think that changes the analysis.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Just briefly, Your Honors, given the power of the objective indicia here, which is up and down the line, copying of the preferred embodiment by two parties, being shocked at the results when you see it, decades of unable to solve the problem, claiming a 1991 patent had the solution the whole time. Meanwhile, the industry with hundreds of millions of dollars isn't fulfilling a need.
Can I just ask you, maybe you've had a little time to think about this while you've been listening to your friend on the other side. If we vacate and remand this and send it back, what do you want us to tell the board to do with regard to secondary consideration evidence?
Right. And that's exactly what I was getting.
Hopefully it avoids this whole presumption issue, because it seems like the board has gotten confused on this presumption issue.
A very wise question, and that's what I was saying. Given the power of that evidence and the fact that the board turned a complete deaf ear to it, and frankly, considering the advocacy on the other side saying that none of these secondary considerations met minimum thresholds of any nexus to even be considered, given that that's likely to repeat below, we think that strong statements about the potential significance of the secondary considerations is worthwhile to give guidance and avoid, as Chief Judge.
Do you think it's necessary to say commensurate in scope doesn't require, if you have a multi-embodiment, a genus claim or a range claim, that the thing being sold, the thing being talked about, the thing being skeptical of has to actually hit every point in that range? I mean, it's actually just implausible.
Your Honor, your Kohler decision, WBIP, I think people call it, really sets it forth well. I think it's the best statement of this point. And Judge Prost touched on this too, which is, if it's a multi-component product like an iPad or something, and you want to say, well, it's an embodiment because it has a thingamajig.
Yeah, but I think what Judge Hughes is getting at, and I just want to sort of, is like, can we avoid getting involved? I mean, what you're talking about is whether the presumption applies or not. I think his question went to, can we forget the presumption and just tell them to look at the evidence? Because notwithstanding how we define what's coextensive and what's not coextensive, they ought to look at the evidence. If the evidence is one embodiment, they ought to tell us whether that's probative.
I agree. I think they should look at all of these questions again. I'm not sure exactly the question, but I think that statements about the quality of the evidence, not conclusions necessarily, that guides them to what would be sufficient nexus in some of these categories would be helpful.
I just want to clarify one point. When I was saying commensurate in scope just now, I wasn't talking about the presumption. I was talking about nexus. Because
yeah.
He is correct that we have opinions on nexus, not the presumption necessarily,
right,
but just nexus, that do talk about evidence being commensurate in scope.
Right.
But I've never understood that to mean that if you have multiple embodiments or a range or whatever, that you can never prove nexus. Forget about the presumption. Presumption out the window. Is that your understanding?
That is absolutely right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
We thank both sides. The case is submitted. That concludes our proceeding for this.